Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Up Your Brave show with Natalie Cutler-Welsh on Reality Check Radio. Next up, I've got two guests together. I'm talking today to Reese Nuttall and Lexi Davis from Antidose Limited on the topic of addictions and recovery. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Natalie. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, Nat, it's good to be here. Thanks for having us.
Well, I know we chatted many months back, and it's such divine timing to have you on the show to talk about this critical topic. For those of you that don't know Reese and Lexi, I'm going to give you a little bit of back information on them. So as a result of his own journey, Reese understands what it feels like to be lost in active addiction and how to find a way out of suffering and back into life. He began pursuing his passion of helping others with volunteer work in the prisons of Southeast Asia. And after returning to New Zealand to progress his studies, Reese found his niche in supporting others to discover their strengths, process their sufferings, and build a new life tailored to their own design. He aims to walk with others from mere survival to truly living. His experience includes 20 years of personal experience with addiction, 15 years professional experience as a counselor specializing in addiction, and 21 years of personal recovery ongoing. Lexi Davis is a dedicated mental health and addictions counselor with a profound understanding of addiction, both professionally and personally, drawing from her own experience with addiction and 17 years in recovery. Lexi offers empathetic and non-judgmental support to her clients, ensuring they feel truly understood. With 15 years professional experience in addiction, Lexi knows that addiction is an isolating and soul-destroying illness that can drive a wedge between loved ones and destroy essential relationships. She provides clients with a unique set of evidence-based skills and personal insights, empowering them to regain control over their addiction and live a life free from its constraints. Well, it's powerful work that you two do. I know you've been through a massive journey to get to this point. Are you able now to elaborate and share with our listeners a little bit more about that journey that brought you to this point where you can now turn around and help others in this area?
Well, look, 100%, Natalie. Originally my journey started because I was born into a family that was rife with addiction. So, you know, my father was drank every day. I never saw him drunk, but he was an alcoholic. And so as I grew, the coping strategies or the comforting, the nurturing inside of my family was fairly limited because of this. It creates a bit of a divide. There was also behavioural issues inside of my family that led me into a teenage year of being quite hurt, quite withdrawn. And when I found alcohol and drugs, it was a way out. It was a way of feeling whole. It was a way of releasing and feeling better from the outside because the in wasn't feeling so good. With a baseline of I wasn't good enough as a narrative. So I took that into my late teen years, and it just ran riot into my 20s. I had a bit of a try it, like it sort of an attitude, try it, like it, do it every day as far as drugs and alcohol went to escape how the deficits of my inner workings at the time. So by the time I was 25, I was using drugs every day. It was something that it was just my constant need to escape. And then when I was 25, it was my first interaction with a jail. So I was arrested and was staring down the barrel of my first lag, as you call it, was prison. So from 25 to 33, it was a general layout of prisons and institutions. So I went into rehab. So I did three programs over that period of time and had a look inside a couple of New Zealand's jail systems. And then when I was 33, it was the birth of my son. And so I'd been inside the using industry for nearly 20 years at that stage. And I'd seen the children that had been raised inside of active addiction. It was very moving. It was very hard to watch. And I swore to myself that if if and or when my own offspring came along, I would step out of that industry. And that's exactly what I did. And I'm really thankful for myself today for doing that. So my boy is now 22. He's never seen me inside of active addiction. He's never had that same sort of upbringing that I did. So I was the intervention in my generational pain, so to speak. And so when I was walking into my own recovery, so 5 or 6 years into it, I moved back up to Southeast Asia because I'd spent a lot of time there in my using days. I was doing lots of naughty stuff at that time in my life. And so when I went back, it was about making new memories and building a new life. And through the encouragement of one of my counselors at the time that I stayed in contact with, the idea of being able to pass on what I'd gained was always reinforced. And so I entered into volunteer work in the districts that I was in around Bangwan Prison, Northern Bangkok, and down in Kirabakan in Bali. And then I realized that I really wanted to learn, and I had an extremely hungry desire to learn more and be able to be as effective in this field as I possibly could be, and at least to know that I'm not doing any harm, been playing with people's mental health. And so I came back in 2012 to complete my studies and reunite my family at that stage due to issues that were going on there. And since then, I've been walking through this path of understanding and knowledge and sharing that with others and walking alongside them while they step out of their own suffering, their own act of addiction. I'm very proud to be that part. As far as being a parent goes, there's not a day doesn't go by that I don't feel so proud that I stepped out and I took that move to be the generational intervention in my family pain. So that thing's quite profound. My son wouldn't know any different, which is epic. It's so good. He doesn't know that. It's about how I feel about me. And so being able to pass that on to others, it's an honor.
I can feel the emotion when you share that story with us. I can see it because we're on video as well. What a massive journey and what a massive turning point for you to say, you know, if I was to, you know, be blessed with children, you know, I'm going to turn things around. And you actually did it. How hard was that struggle for you to go from that life to shifting the way that you operate? You know, instead of numbing tactics, you're actually facing things head on. Like on a scale of 1 to 10, how hard was that to turn things around?
It's hard to put it on a scale because it took me to cut myself off from everybody that I knew at that stage. Mm. My life had become everything I talked about, everything I thought about, my actions, who I surrounded myself with was saturated in using substances of all kinds at that stage. So I needed to step out of that. It's what I call into no man's land. Yeah. That's one of the places that I help people to walk through now. No man's land is where you take your old clothes off before you put your new ones on. It's in between the using days, the existence of being inside of active addiction, everything you know, and dropping that suffering identity before you find out who you are and connect again and start to create and build a new life that's very, very different to the suffering that you've just been enduring for decades. So, yeah, it's hard to put it into a scale, but it's incredibly rewarding. Mm. Yeah. Incredibly rewarding. It takes and very fearful. We need help when we step through that area. That's why I do what I do. Nobody can do that stuff on their own. It's such a cold, lonely place. So yeah.
Well, in a moment, we're going to come back to you, and I'd love to hear some specific things that maybe you did or that you advise some of the people you work with to do to navigate through that cold and lonely place and to up their brave, right? Because they need to face that fear. What about you, Lexi? Can you give us a little window into your own personal journey and how it led you to now be such an incredible counselor helping so many people?
Yeah, sure. And similar story to Reese, really. You know, dysfunctional family. I was adopted, so there was a bit of like abandonment stuff that went on in my life and being relatively lost growing up and not really knowing where I belonged. And I was a bit late in starting my drug using. But by the age of 24, 25, I was definitely, getting inside of addiction. But of course thinking, you know, I was a little smarter than all the rest and it wouldn't happen to me. And I could stop when I wanted. And, you know, like obviously over a period of time, it's very progressive. So you don't actually notice it where the master became the slave. And denial became my best friend. which kind of allowed me to continue on with that journey. It was such an interesting thing to reflect back on at how that all happened, of you systematically give up everything for one thing and you still think that you've got this, you know, like the insanity of the thinking was, yeah, unbelievable on reflection. And in the end, of course, like Reese, jails, institutions, and almost death was kind of like where it ended. And like Reese too, facing down the barrel of quite a long jail sentence as a result of my drug using. So for me, though, I came in to recovery completely under duress. Like, I so did not want to give up. I was not interested. And I was really just in treatment to tick the boxes to get out of jail or get out of the crap that I was in. And then, of course, I had full intentions of going back to going and doing what I was doing. But, you know, over a period of time of being in treatment, which obviously was, you know, mandatory at the time, it changed over a period of time. And the longer I stayed in it, things started to improve. It was interesting. But it was also about, like Reese said, about the therapist that I met. And I went through a number of therapists who, of course, as soon as I spotted that they didn't have an addiction history, I was like, well, you don't know what it's like to live in my head. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to listen to you. I was always looking for the reason to not have anything to do with any of the therapists or take on board what they said and undermine their experience. So that was usually my first avenue, was to undermine that area. And then when I finally met a therapist that was in recovery and just understood what it was like to live in my head, that made a huge difference to me. Like, that made a huge difference. And by that stage in my life, I'd like destroyed everything. So I had nobody left in my corner. And this therapist he was amazing. He was so good and really supported me, you know, he really, really supported me. And that meant the world to me. So I handed over my complete trust to him, because clearly I couldn't be trusted with my thinking. Like, I could not use the same thinking that had got me to this point to get me back out of it. Mm-hmm. Like, let me loose and it was going to turn to disaster. Like, you just couldn't leave me to make a decision, because, yeah, it was going to be wrong. So, of course, you know, like, that rapport, that connection was hugely beneficial to me, trusting in the process. And I just constantly go to him, tell me what to do next. I would just do everything he said, because my way didn't work. And eventually, you know, that got me through that process that I was in. And like Reese too, I'm motivated towards like doing my degree. Again, I wasn't like very confident, but I just kept doing what my therapist told me to do. I just kept following his instructions and upped my brave through that for a long period of time. And yep, did my degree, did all that stuff. And it just kept going. It just kept flowing. And yeah, so yeah, didn't look back. But it's such an incredible journey to look back on, because yeah, the person I was 17 years ago would have just laughed at saying that I would be here today having a conversation with you about this stuff. So in a nutshell, that's pretty much kind of my story. And eventually I just had to give up one thing for everything. And, you know, like we say, you give up everything for one thing, and then recovery goes, you have to give up one thing for everything. And that's true. You only have to change one thing in recovery, and that's everything. And if you're ready to do that, then you can have your life, you know, you can get a life back, or, you know, that life beyond your wildest dreams, as they say. And it's true.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for your absolute transparency there, you know, sharing what you've been through. And Lexi, when you're talking about how you were undermining these therapists and like just being super transparent. And I'm sure there will be a lot of people listening that can absolutely relate to that. Some of your experiences from the addiction ruling their life, possibly some of our listeners also with the jail experience and going through a lot of therapists, and it doesn't resonate with them and it doesn't work. I'd love to ask, because I genuinely don't know, Lexi, I don't have a lot of experience in this area, but what I'm wondering, when you talked about your mindset of going, I can stop when I want to, you know, that master and slave or the denial. Is that really common? Would you say, is that common, or is it, it's a different experience for everybody?
That's really common. It's really common. And one thing we notice, like, addiction is really complex to understand, but it's very mechanical in the way it works. And so, you know, there's stages of this that people come into that we, you know, we meet people at, and they are very much in certain stages of readiness, and some are just really not ready. So that beginning stage of that pre-contemplative stage is 100% where it's at. And most of us, all, yeah, we all go through that of, what problem? I don't have a problem. Like, I can stop when I want. Yeah, it's, this is the thing of where it's really hard to understand addiction, because it sounds insane trying to say, like, you know, like, it actually changes the way you think. Like, it fully changes the way you think. And so therefore you can't access a lot of your mind that you used to be able to. So it does, it changes the way you think. And you are just in such a state of denial that you know you've got this and you can stop whenever you want, and you're choosing not to. And it's just, yeah, we just manufacture BS and we believe it.
Well, Reese, I'll go to you. And how can we turn things around if we are, if some people are in this addiction state, whatever they might be addicted to, because there's all sorts of substances and practices and things. What are some guidance that you can share, maybe for someone that themselves actually has an addiction, whether they're willing to acknowledge that or not? What are some things that people can do in that early stage to just even start to turn things around?
Yeah. Oh, look, it's and it is, like, as Lexi said, I mean, the protective mechanisms of addiction are going to say that you're okay when you're absolutely not. So you'll hear it, like, if anybody's an active at the moment, the first thing they'll hear are the people around them going, hey, maybe you want to have a look at that. Or, are you kidding? Did you really do that? Or is it, crikey, you're drinking a lot? Or, you know, we just start seeing the signs. So with somebody inside of active, it's really interesting. I think it's important for them to actually look at the debris that they're leaving behind, and try to see outside of themselves at who else has been affected here, or who else could possibly be affected. I love working with parents. I love working with parents because it's really mechanical the way our minds work. I mean, as Lex said before, I mean, addiction runs on machinery. It is. It's very mechanical. It turns over like clockwork inside every individual person, whether it's an eating disorder to gambling to heroin use to alcohol. It's the same machinery that wraps itself around a personality and a person to individualize itself according to their characteristics. So it's incredibly manipulative and incredibly mechanical at the same time. However, as far as our minds go, we are very influential or influenced. So when I'm looking at parents, especially with somebody inside of active addiction, or it's a good way of sort of having a check up on whether they're okay or not, is by gathering seeing what they're doing, what they're consuming on a day-to-day basis, and checking in with themselves if that was okay, if their children was doing that. Yeah, because it can get, put a little bit of stark reality into it. So if it's okay for you to drink every day, why isn't it okay if your daughter was doing that as well? Because, you know, us parents, we are very connected in some way or other to our children. You know, it's about unconditional love. And so are they. And so we will show them how to walk through this earth being healthy addicts or not, how to manage things well or not. And so we pick up on all of these characteristics behaviorally from our parents initially. They don't mean to show that, but it's been us, it's our chance to be really aware of what that is, being aware of our behaviors and how influential that can be. And so if it's not okay for our children to be doing it, why is it okay for us to be hurting ourselves in that manner? So, you know, just putting a little bit of stark reality, if they want to see whether it makes common sense or not, because common sense doesn't come into addictive mechanics. So the thinking behind addiction, as Lexi was saying before, it's quite insane. It's doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, you know? And so always chasing something, but never actually getting there because it's insatiable. And so if we put common sense into it and we say, so if I, you know, if we gauge it against something that makes sense and it doesn't, if that thought pattern doesn't make sense, then like, oh, look, I've had a really hard day. I know how to make it better I'll just have two beers and I'll be able to relax or something. And you put common sense in, well, if it was a hard day at work, would you not want to lie around in a bath, have a really good meal, maybe cuddle your kids, and just kick back and have an early snooze on the couch and wake up in the morning feeling refreshed rather than pouring poison down your throat and giving you a rotten sleep or a pass out and waking up after having saying things to your partner that you didn't mean to? So, you know, if we put common sense up against it, it's really good. So as far as entering into what that looks like, I would tool yourself up. Dr. Google doesn't work because Dr. Google will put addictive tendencies through the addictive lens, through the addictive mind, which will make everything okay for you. That's why it's really important to talk to other people, especially other people that understand what addiction looks like, which is people that have been through it before. You know, the fellowships and that are really good for surrounding yourself by people that are like-minded, that understand. But if we look for a solution through addictive eyes, we will just get more denial, which will fuel itself to keep going, if you get what I mean. So basically, if it's not okay for our kids or it's not okay for our friends to be doing what we're doing, then you want to put your hand up and go, hey, maybe I just need to have a look at something. Just check in with a professional. Just check in with somebody to start to gather some information or bounce it off somebody that's not emotionally tied to you. Not a family member, not your partner, not your children. If you get what I mean, somebody that we do not have a tie to, because then we're more likely to listen to them than someone else without defensiveness. Mm. Yeah.
One of the things I think you both mentioned, and Lexi, you talked about it, is having to move away or distance yourself from some people when you wanted to make that turnaround. Mm. What about people out there who they're not necessarily surrounded by other people who are doing the same addictive behaviors? They actually are doing most of it on their own, possibly secretly. What is some advice for them to make a change?
Yeah. And I think, and that's a really good one, because a lot of the time things do end up very isolated and alone. Like, quite often going through the stages is, some of it's social, but then it becomes quite isolating because, of course, we get quite afraid of judgment and what other people think. So we, you know, become more isolated and alone. And, you know, and so that's not uncommon for a lot of people to sort of be at home and on their own drinking or using drugs and stuff. And I think a lot of it is too around, you know, asking yourself that question around, so what am I losing out on by not making change? Or what am I losing out on by doing this? Because that's the reality, is there is so much that people are losing out on. And the psychology behind all this is quite interesting around, often we try to go, so what have you got to gain? Like, focus on the things that you've got to gain by making changes or doing something. But often people, you know, they don't kind of really get motivated on the gains, because it could be self-doubt and other things, but they quite often motivated by loss. And so the fact behind that is, when people think they're losing something, like, I'm losing out on, I don't know, like spending time and watching my kids or going traveling or whatever, lots of stuff you're obviously losing out on. Mm. Quite often people then are like, shit, you know, like, I'm really losing out on life. Like, I've just sat here for 5 years drinking my life away, and well, everybody else is out there living their life, so there's a lot of loss. So a lot of it is getting people to kind of think about it from that perspective as well. Yeah. And also it's a big part about encouraging people to understand that this isn't about a moral issue or willpower. This is like, that's why the willpower method doesn't work, because it's not, this is like, well, sometimes you hear disease or it's an illness. And so understanding that this is actually an illness and our brains work differently, so that people can kind of get away from the stigma of addiction of being, I'm a bad person because I've got this issue. And so therefore I need to hide away. And it's like, no. Addiction only survives in the dark. It cannot survive in the light. And the more we can talk about this openly, away from judgment, the better it is. Like, yeah, then people can get help without judgment.
I'm just going to kind of generalize here. I feel like if every person with an addiction had an opportunity to share the backstory of the journey that led them there, I think most people would understand. You know, they would be more compassionate, more empathetic. But I think people don't tend to to do that. They don't tend to share that story, but when they do seek help, you just said willpower doesn't work. Can you share with us now? We'll go to you, Reese, and Lexi second. What does work? What are some things that people can do? So whether they are the person with the addiction or they're the family member or the friend who wants to help, what are some things that do work?
Oh, well, look, I'll just run you a couple of things really through how I work with my clients. I mean, a lot of it, we need to actually take things out and put them down in front of us a lot of the time because it's our thinking. So the addiction lives and thrives inside of discombobulation, so to speak. So it's a cloudy old mind. It's always racing. There's so many thoughts. It hangs on to drama. It looks for drama, creates it, because it's a smokescreen of mirrors that it survives inside of and can navigate and then tell you at the end of the day over here that, but you'll be okay. We'll just have a couple of drinks or something just to take the edge off, just, you know, and that sort of thing. And it continues along that way. So what I'm talking about here is like, one, seek help. Talk to somebody that's not emotionally tied to you. Really important, not your friend. I mean, you can listen to your friends, but we're always worried. We've got an ego. We've got a face to keep up. We're good at changing hats or stepping up on the stage for different people. But when we're sitting in front of somebody that we don't know, we've got actually no need to be doing that. So we can drop all our defenses. So that's the beauty of being able to talk to somebody like that. Also, draw things out. Start writing them down, taking them out of your mind. You know, scrambled eggs is where it lives, if you don't mind me saying. So if we can pick everything out and put it down on paper in front of us, start to take a log of turning that vision around to look at yourself every single day. That's what we call journaling. People call it a diary or whatever, but journaling can be really important for you just to start having a look, because the addiction does not want you to look at you. It does not. It is like it's what I call the monster in the mind. So it's driving your bus. It takes over your assets. So it takes over your willpower and your smarts. It hijacks your brain. It's your assets. This is your willpower. This is your smarts. That's why most addiction is based around, you know, quite high cognitive level. It's stimulated by how much smarts you've got. And the willpower is really strong inside of addicts. It really is. So, but alongside that, you've got huge emotional flow, which is what they always talk about taking the edge off, because it's about navigating, understanding how to process this emotion, which we never get taught as children, right? Mm-hmm. So if we write it all out, if we start having to look at ourselves with the journaling, talking to somebody that we don't know about it, and then start gathering information about you and looking at what's okay for you and what's not, looking at the behaviors that are supporting it, what is... Crikey, I could ramble on about this all day. As you see, it's a circus. Now I'm talking about the ringleader of the circus. It's the monster of the mind. It is driving your bus. Mm. You need to have a look at, if you're on this merry-go-round inside the circus, what it is to take out these integral parts of the merry-go-round to stop it spinning. At one end is the using. Yeah, that's a given, but it's not about the alcohol or the drugs. It's not. Addiction's not about that. That's what it uses to hijack you at the end of the day, make you feel bad about yourself, but it's not about that. It's about everything else around on this merry-go-round. It's the people you hang out with, the places you go, the music you listen to, the movies you watch. It's about your thinking and what continues that thinking and brings some exit in place. At one end, we've got a rhetoric, which is the monster that tells you when you wake up in the morning that you're not good enough, that you've done something wrong, that you're bad. And then by the time the morning moves on, it's telling you that at the other end of the circus is you're using. But by two, we'll be able to get this at the bottle store, or, you know, it's already talking and it consumes your mind doing that. So if we start writing down what that merry-go-round looks like, we can start peeling out what's going on here. There's a whole lot of other stuff over here. It's called trauma. That it's based on, we'll get to that. But initially, for somebody, it's about taking things out and having a look. What's okay? What are the good side of things? And what are the not so good side of things at the moment? Why would I keep using? What am I getting from it? What's it doing for me? What's the not so good things? What does that look like? I can guarantee the list of this one's going to be 10 times bigger than this one. But it doesn't deny the fact that some part of using was and or is good. Yeah, at one stage it was all parties, then it was parties and consequence, and then it just ended up a consequence. But there's still a reason why you're using, and then we need to see the fallout. So it's getting both of those out to start with. Yeah. Then there's a life-changing experience on the way.
Yeah.
That's such a good point about them acknowledging what is it actually providing for me, and which is part of the reason they keep going, I imagine. And then I think, as Lexi, you were talking about, you know, what am I losing? So what is it costing you, essentially? And that's the reality check moment, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And some of those type places that you get to when you ask yourself those questions, and many of us just avoid it because we don't talk about it. Mm. And, you know, on that sort of topic around how to reach out and what to do, it's about putting your hand up, and it's about actually talking to somebody about it, because secrets keep you sick, and you're as sick as your secrets. So it's so important to know that you cannot do this on your own. You cannot make rules with yourself around how you're going to cut back or what you're going to do. It just doesn't work. Like, you need to reach out, and you need to be able to talk to somebody about this that understands this. I love the saying around, this is the only war that you have to surrender to win. And it's so true, because, of course, you know, guns on the table, hands in the air. This is your way to beat this, is to surrender, and then you'll win. It's crazy, because most of us don't want to do that. We're like, no, I'm going to fight this. I'm going to beat this. No, it will beat you if you keep doing that. You will never win that war. So, you know, like, just put your hand up and reach out and talk to somebody is the first step in starting that process. And yeah, it may take a while to get to where you want to go, but this is a journey, not a race. And people have to be patient with this. I've also heard sayings around, you know, it's taken you this long to get this messed up. There was some more colourful language about that one, but anyway, I'm being good. So it's going to take a little while to unmess yourself, which is true, you know, like it is. It's about being patient, because addiction does start with pain and it ends with pain. And as you start this journey, you realise that there's so much more to you're using and why than you probably ever thought. So,
Well, it really is people upping their brave, I think. Really, like, kudos to anyone that does reach out and get help, because that is truly upping their brave, saying, listen, I realize I can't do it on my own. I thought I could will myself through this, but I keep taking, you know, one step forward and seven back. Reese, can you share an example, if you're able, without breaking confidentiality, of anyone that you've worked with in the past few years that you've seen them really overcome this, and just a little story to inspire some of our listeners? And maybe within that story, there's a few strategies or tips that you can share as well.
Oh, crikey. There's been a few. I can kind of like just condense, if you like, this, you know, because of course confidentiality is incredibly important. So of course I won't breach any of that, but however it's, yeah, I mean, okay, so I get this fairly often. Like, people come to me sometimes, or I'll get the phone call from, because I'm a bloke, right? So sometimes I'll get the phone calls from a wife or the partner, the girlfriend, going, "Hey, look, my husband's in trouble. My husband's you know, his behaviours are this. He's drinking too much and that, but the husband's not actually ready for it. He's going, but I deserve it. I get home from work and it's my thing. We're allowed one sort of crutch and that, and so I get quite a bit of that. But then once they come and sit down with me and you know, just recently, like a couple of days ago, I was in my office and one of my clients that stays on with maintenance, so to speak, just so, you know, checks in. I'm Mr. Accountability once a month kind of thing, just to clarify.
Well, I imagine that's critical.
Oh, it's really important, because the monster in the mind's very manipulative. So it finds its way in somewhere. You know, the program doesn't go away. It just gets a lot weaker and quieter over here. Yeah, and when we're not looking at it, it's behind us doing something quite sneaky. That's how addiction works. Well, it's how it keeps promoting itself into a position of control. And so this client in particular, he did incredibly well. So it was one of those, like, pre-contemplative, as my wife introduced him to me, and they're sitting there, and yeah, of course, it's really self-destructive behaviors. It is only 3 days a week, but I'm only drinking 3 days a week. So, you know, I'm not an addict. I'm just, yeah, how long have you been doing? Oh, 20 years. Yeah, okay, yeah, sure. And so, do you miss any weekend? No, I don't miss any weekends. How many days a week do you think about it? Oh, you know, I do like my build up, you know, so Tuesday, and I start drinking on like Thursday evening sometimes. It's like, yeah, okay. So then we work out and we peel it on out until he reveals to himself that actually it has been hiding under that veil because he's not happy about it, because he's not been attentive and the weekends are gone. So he works all week and then his weekends are just a blur of feeling sick and not connecting with his kids. And then we have a look and he has all the wander back and sees that that's what his dad used to do. It's like, yeah, okay, so what was that like? You know, and wander back into the childhood, especially between 5 years and 12 years of age, between 5 and 12, when all our belief system is set into place, when our subconscious sense of whether the world is safe or not, where our sense of what trust looks like, whether our parents have got our back or not, whether we're actually connected, whether it's cold, whether it's warm, how to navigate that heightened sense of emotional load. And between this, so we wandered back into there and we find the trauma sitting inside a boarding school. We find that abandonment that was quite profound. So, you know, went home in the weekends, but dad was drinking and working all weekend. So never had that role model sort of how to be a man on a healthy basis and what coping strategies were slammed into place. And so we went back and we unpacked all of that. That's one of the things I really love doing. I'm an unpacker. And I like to walk alongside people while they pull out their childhood trauma. And trauma comes in different packages. People go, oh, look, I'm not traumatized. It's fairly often I hear that. I'm not traumatized. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not traumatized. No, yes. But then when we go back in and we open the curtains and we peel back a few memories, we have a look under this one, we find underneath here. And then there's an emotion attached to it. So we peel that one up and we have a look at that. And look, there's some more. And we start opening up and entering into the hippocampus or the amygdala, emotional memory. And we find that there's an underlying base of tears. And so this is very real for me. A couple of days ago, I feel so proud of him because it does take courage. And initially when you walk into my office, sometimes like, I haven't got a problem. The wife's got the problem because I'm only drinking 3 days a week. It's like, yeah, okay. And then it took some time for this to come to the place that we are now, but he's free.
Mm.
He's free with his children. He's free with his wife. He's free from his past torment that he had a very limited awareness of it even existing. And so he doesn't drink anymore. He's been off alcohol for over 12 months now and just checks in with me once a month to make sure that this old creepy old monster doesn't come back and you know, hijack him again. But that's just one little thing. There's so many stories. Mm. This is why I do my job. Yeah, 100%.
When he comes into your office, question, did the wife come with him or was it him solo?
Look, I really like it when all the cards are put on the table. So sometimes the husband will come first, or sometimes the wife comes first. So it's different, but I really like to have them in the office. Let's set this on the way, because then each partner knows what their role in moving forward looks like. Because basically when it comes to recovery, especially recovery from self-destructive behaviors and addiction, it's the person themselves' responsibility to take responsibility of that. And for the partner to, I always give the partner something else to do too, because they've been traumatized too by watching the self-destructive notions of addiction take over their partner. And it's very, very traumatic. And then there's the energy in the house and that, which is, so they've both got a role to play, but it's quite different.
Hmm.
And so it's really important for them. Actually, at times I really like it when they'll sit down initially, maybe for a couple of sessions, just to get the ball rolling, to see what role each person has got to play, how much space each person needs, and you know, and just to set the ball rolling. Also clarity, because on the outside somebody sees behaviors a lot clearer than somebody else from the outside looking into somebody. We can see the behaviors really clearly, and behaviors exhibit what's going on inside people. Yeah, our external behaviors betray what's happening in here.
What comes to mind for me is it's never too late to change. And I guess there might be people, if you've just joined us, you're listening to the Up Your Brave show with Natalie Cutler-Welsh. And I'm talking today to Reese Nuttall and Lexi Davis on the topic of addictions and recovery. We would love to hear your thoughts. We would love to hear your questions if you got some 2057 on the text or email inbox at realitycheck.radio. Yeah, I feel like it's never too late. There must be some people listening that are thinking, oh, like, you know, maybe I could have done that 5 years ago, but, you know, it's too late to change, or I'm too old, or I'm too addicted. Lexi, do you have any stories, without breaking confidentiality, or strategies that you'd like to share around that theme, maybe, of it's never too late, or anyone that you've seen really make a massive turnaround?
Oh, yeah. And again, so many stories over the last 15 years that it would be hard to find one that I could even highlight. But and really just talking more around that generalizing of the experience of watching people like come in so broken and so like hopeless and helpless. And you know, like, and then being able to watch people systematically grow and flourish and start like, you know, doing things they never thought they would ever be able to do. And just, you know, from even to the point of meeting their partners and having babies and like going from like alone and broken with a bottle to, you know, giving birth to their first child a couple of years later and just like flourishing to watch that happen. And, you know, kind of just to see people like really get those epiphanies of, now I know why nothing was working, like nothing was working. And then to see everything start to just work and their lives to start to come alive. It's such an amazing journey. But of course, you know, sometimes you've really got to go through some really ugly stuff to get to that kind of place of growth. And yeah, like there's so many journeys that I've been through with people. As they get into the real hard part, like the core of the onion or the peeling back layers of the onion, to get to where the root cause of all their pain is or whatever that it is for that individual, and then just watching them grow and start to develop a relationship with themselves. And, you know, the confidence that you see in people as they start to realize that they can do whatever they want to do. Like nothing is holding them back. And some of them like, man, have just left me in awe on the life they've developed in their recovery, you know? And it's like, it's such an honor to be a part of people's journeys like that. It's such an honor. And I always remember when I first started studying to be a therapist is like, if I can change or help one person's life or turn one person's life around and be a part of that, then it would make all the suffering that I went through in my life worthwhile. Like if I could just be a part of that and help one person break those chains of addiction and get away from this monster that lives in our minds, or at least learn how to train it, then it would make it all worthwhile. And I've seen that so many times now over the years I've been working. It's just, yeah, it's what keeps me going on the daily.
Well, hey, if we can inspire one or ideally hundreds of people from this one radio interview to reach out, you know, to take that step and get help and change the direction of their life, then I'll be so happy. That's what I'm here for, to share your message. And so if anyone's listening, even if you can just share this video, you know, with a friend, you can private message it to them casually with the replay link, or hey, go ahead and post it on your Facebook page and just say, hey, for whoever this might help. Yeah. Because I think collectively we can help. A lot of people, as you mentioned, Reese, have been through massive trauma, and it's not their fault. You know, this is life circumstance, but we can help them turn things around. So my next question for you, Reese, is what if you're the bystander or whatever, the loved one or the friend? What guidance do you have for the friend or the loved one who sees this pain happening in front of them? How can they support their person who may not be open to the support? What words of wisdom can you share with them?
Oh, look, okay. So you know, for every active addict that we know, everybody that's immersed inside of active addiction, there will be 10 people directly affected by what they're doing around them, which is a staggering statistic. So it's absolute mayhem. They're just like this little bomb site. But they don't like to think so, right? But for the people that love, that care, it's about, a lot of this is about, you're going to need your energy, especially the closer you are to this person. You're going to need to really take care of yourself. Self-care is really important, yeah? And so not becoming part of the issue as well, yeah? So take a step back, gather some information, and it's like planting seeds, you know. It's not about hounding that person, because the person that's inside of active addiction, every single one of them have got "I'm not good enough" rhetoric down underneath everything. Yeah. They've got negative self-worth battering away at them every time they wake up in the morning. And so they don't need any help with that. However, just a little bit of our inspiration about, maybe you could try this, I've heard about that. And yes, drop some phone numbers, or, you know, put some inroads in that that they could actually possibly follow up. The becoming part of the problem or enabling them to a degree is an issue. So like for parents, it's really hard for us parents as far as like, you know, being unconditionally loving somebody to actually step back and allow them to do what they're doing when you know it's incredibly self-destructive, or to give them a warm, what I call a warm bed and a full fridge, they're not going to stop.
Right.
You know, so if you're looking at your husband or your wife, and they're deep inside of their addiction and that, and you're running around like a blue ass fly trying to cover the bat or wrap them up in cotton wool, it doesn't actually work. It doesn't. I'm not talking about tough love by any means. I'm talking about not supporting a self-destructive notion, and it will take you to the cleaners. It hoovers, addiction hoovers up. It will never take enough, and it will take more. So be careful about financing it. Be careful about supporting it as far as a warm bed and a full fridge goes, because there will never be enough finance. There will never be enough comfort while it goes and disrespects everything that is around it to try and push people away and isolate that person. So all I'm saying here is really be careful about enabling. Enabling is a real catchphrase. It's a real word that's very real as far as it goes. It's the first go-to for most people that loves an active addict. And so if we're stepping back from enabling, we've just got to come forward with some phone numbers or some suggestions, and just to remind them, hey, look, I really love you, but I can't support these behaviors anymore.
Yeah. And that takes a lot of courage as well to do that.
Courage. It takes huge courage. Yeah. It's not about cutting them off from love, because you're not going to. No, that's what they're doing. That's what they're doing with their active addiction. That's what active addiction does. No, so it does. It takes a lot of courage, but just providing information, being there, stepping back and allowing them to take responsibility for their addiction, their recovery, and taking care of themselves. You know, like, take your time out. Take your walk on the beach. Talk to your friends. Take care of yourself, because you're going to need your energy recovering, watching somebody recover over here. It's a fairly lengthy process, and it's a little bit grueling if we're always inside it. Mm. So definitely stepping back and looking after yourself.
Lexi, anything you want to add there?
I mean, it's an interesting one for family, because we often see family really trying harder than the person that's using to fix this problem. And of course, if you just love them a little longer or hold on a little more, then maybe we'll turn a corner. But unfortunately, that actually can enable the behavior to continue. Most people don't decide to make changes until they've usually had some defining moment, like rock bottom, or something really massive. And family can often get in the way of some of the most beneficial consequences to change, because they're so there to fix it, because they don't want anything bad to happen. Actually, we need to look at this differently. Sometimes some of those things can actually motivate massive change in an individual. So we've got to like get the support to know how to do this, because it's usually the opposite to what any parent or anybody who cares about another person would do. And so getting support on doing that is really important, because, like I say, it's very hard to love somebody who's in active addiction, because, that active addict is just looking at taking advantage over anybody who still cares, and it will literally manipulate, and it's cunning, manipulative, and deceitful.
It's hungry.
And hungry. And it doesn't care about your relationship. It doesn't care about how much you should mean to them. It doesn't care about that. So it's learning the strategies to put in place so that you don't inadvertently enable the addiction to continue way longer than it needed to. That's what happened with me in my life, was it was enabled for far too long, but then I can't blame anybody for that, because I was highly manipulative and I knew how to work it. So it was very hard to get through to me. Those consequences really needed to happen for me to be able to make change. And, you know, it wasn't until those consequences were so big that, you know, my mother couldn't come down and like swipe the credit card to get me out of the shit little than this time. Yeah. And I had to face the music. And yeah, it was pretty loud music.
Well, thank you for putting your card, both of you, thank you for putting your cards on the table. I know that this will resonate with so many people. And if this gives them not only hope, but a pathway towards change, I think we've done some good work today. In a moment, I'm going to ask you how people can get in touch. But first, I'm going to ask you the Up Your Brave question. If you were to truly up your brave in the remaining months of 2024, what would you do? Reese.
Oh, crikey. Reese, up in my brave. Oh, look, I've got a hungry brain. I found when I stopped using a long time ago, a while ago, a couple of decades ago now, that I had a hungry mind. So I'm always into researching and learning. So upping my brave at the moment, I mean, I've been through, you know, all the different modalities, trying to strengthen my practice. But at the moment, after the hypnotherapies and it's gone into, like, I'm looking into what like Gabo Mate and a few others are looking into about generational pain, about the deep trauma, especially because of things like our mind is really wired to protect us from pain. It doesn't differentiate, right? So when we give like traumatic instances or events in our lives, sometimes we can have those memory blanks. So, you know, for me, I couldn't remember 7 to 8 or early 14. So, you know, these sort of things, they punctuate some people's lives. Some people have got really limited memories of what goes on between 5 and 12 alone. And so to be able to access those, I mean, I've been walking down that path and trying different modalities and different approaches with different people for a long time. And I don't think I can ever stop progressing on that. So to up my brave at the moment, I'm looking into all the research that has been done since the 50s and that it's all exploded again across the earth around the psychedelic therapies, et cetera, and be able to access or fire up the neural pathways that lead us into our hard drive, the hippocampus in our brain, and especially like the emotional memory bank, which is our amygdala, because we need to break through that the trauma safe, so to speak. So into the pain body, what Eckhart Tolle would call into the pain body. Mm-hmm. So we need to understand what that looks like, what that is to be able to access it and process it. And so sometimes, so now, you know, I'm learning a lot about things along the lines of I have to be very careful with the psychedelic therapies because I'm training up very well, very capable inside of those on an official basis. However, they're not legal across the world as yet, but I'm going to be ready. However, what I'm looking at the moment with the psilocybins and that and lysergic acid, not so much, but things that aren't so addictive because I'm specializing in addiction, so I need to be careful. MDMA and ketamine and those sort of things that they're using across the planet now, actually openly in Australia, even down in Tauranga, they're using ketamine therapies for chronic depression. That's not my focus. My focus is allowing the brain in certain ways to hotwire the talking of the neural pathways and neuroplasticity along the lines of opening up memory banks to release or be aware of the trauma inside. All addiction is based on trauma, all of it. And so I find that we've got a shocking success percentage rate in the fellowships, and I'm pretty damn sure I know why. We need to access the drivers of addiction. The drivers of addiction are trauma. We need to access, understand, be aware of it, and process that. So upping my brave at the moment is going where others have been before. However, extending my knowledge and expanding into areas to be able to help others to access and process their pain so we don't have to go back or we're not so damn vulnerable is taking the bullets out of the gun of addiction, really. That's what
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. It's powerful work. And yeah, that's so great that you're kind of forging the way researching and seeing what strategies are going to work. Because some people, you're right, they've not intentionally, but they've blocked out the memories. They just don't have them. So they actually might not even understand why they feel this pain within them or this sadness within. So good on you with all that work. What about you, Lexi? What does upping your brave look like to you?
Yeah. And I guess if I think about that, it's probably having more conversations like this, like actually taking the time to do this. It's really easy to be in the counseling room with an individual and just working. However, it's about it's about being more open and talking about this, I think, you know, is one thing. It's about upping my brave. But it's also for me about like continuing with the alternative therapies of more, and mine is probably more interested in, you know, the more neurodiverse, the spicy brain, and developing and continuing to develop modalities and things that work better for the more neurodiverse rather than a neurotypical. We are coming into that time where everybody is a little neurodiverse, which I love. But of course, this is leaving behind some of the very old neurotypical programs that they kind of work for people, but they don't really. And so evolving treatment in a way that helps to support people with the more neurodiverse brains and personality types is really where my brave, upping my brave is.
Oh, that is so amazing. And by the way, at the end of this episode, I often mention, if you like this, you'll also like that. So I can mention some other interviews, but I recently did one about neurodiversity. And I love that you specifically can help people who can relate to that, the spicy brain. Where can people find you? I know you two are located geographically, I think in Whangaparoa, and I imagine you work online as well as in person. Yeah. Where can people find you and what is coming up in the coming months?
So where would I work? I work out of home in Manly in Whangaparoa a couple of days a week, so Mondays and Thursdays. I've also got an office in Birkenhead that I'm in on a Tuesday. And as far as Zoom meetings go, you know, yes, we're online every day of the week generally, except bar the weekends, of course. So we can access it. I mean, we've got clients coming to privacies and so Zoom or technology is wonderful because, you know, it can break the traffic jam. It can breach the international boundaries. That's fantastic. You know, sometimes I'll be talking to London at 7 o'clock at night and Hong Kong in the afternoon. It's a beautiful thing. It's really good. So we've got the connections like that. So you can access us. Yeah,
you can jump on our website, which is addictionscounsellors.co.nz, also antidose.co.nz. Just type in antidose, it'll come up. So Google is definitely the way to find us there. Mm-hmm.
About social media? Are you on LinkedIn or Instagram or Facebook?
Facebook, we've both got our own professional pages under our names. And so, you know, we kind of like share a lot of stuff from addiction and things like that on those pages. So, apart from that, it's just really our website and Facebook. We're not real big on social media and all of, you know,
you're just busy doing the work.
Addictive, right? Another thing. They're scrolling TikTok in the middle of the night.
No,
gotta go.
We do not promote social media use, but however, we have got a presence here. Yes. So online, on Zoom, website, Messenger, you know, through Facebook and that, 100%. Give us a ring.
I would love to know also, so in terms of what's coming up, do you mainly work privately with people, so one-on-one or husband and wife combo, or do you also do group coaching?
We did try that originally, but you know, in our beginning stages of when we very first started Antidose, but no, it's predominantly one-to-one now. And I mean, we obviously have, you know, couples and things like that, but we've just got to that individual counselling. A lot of it's online now, so it just seems to have kind of developed in that area. So,
a lot of work that a lot of people that I work with now is they don't like to be so publicly exposed, etc. You know, so a lot of people, you know, we've got the fellowships out there which are fantastic, AA, NA, you know, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous. GA, all that, you know, SLA, all those the different fellowships. And they're great. We certainly promote, you know, encourage people to check in with them. However, we do find a lot of people that come to us are not looking for public exposure.
Yeah.
And a lot of work that I do is very intimate. It's very inside. It's going in to meet, it's inner child work. So it's meeting the younger person inside the adult, who invariably has been left behind somewhere. So we need to go back and get them.
Absolutely. So, it sounds like discreet and deep work that you do.
Yeah, discreet, very confidential, very quiet. It's not publicly exposed. Yeah, it's very intimate.
Yeah. Mm.
Amazing. So powerful. Thank you so much for joining us today. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners before we wrap things up?
Actually, there is. We have just put our online course online. We've got BS-free guide to giving up, to kicking the habit, that's what it is, on our website. And so you can download that and have us on your screen every day for 6 weeks, sharing our personal and professional experience with the treatment of addiction. It is obviously a BS-free guide. So, you know, it's not your kind of neurotypical program. And it does. It shares some real life experience and the daily kind of like video clips and what else has it got? The readings and the questions and the topics. 6 weeks, it runs you through a pretty intense program to help you kind of really get on track. So that's on our website.
That's a really good one, for especially for introduction. You know, people that are still using, still drinking, whatever, still caught inside addiction. It's a great one because it's really cheap, so to speak, for every day to have a sitting in your face sort of thing. You can flick it open every day in your email. You'll have a short video. It's about 5 minutes of us talking about certain things, but it also reminds you of that you're not alone, because we share our own personal experience in this, because that's isolation is a real problem with addictions. And then it goes through all the different components of changing your life, what you can look at. And so it gives the person, like what I was talking about with journaling before, it gives the person a chance just to reflect on themselves at the beginning or end or middle of each day, once a day, really important, for 6 weeks. This is every day for 6 weeks. So, you know, I really promote that, and they can work out whether this is okay if they've stopped, or they want to stop, or they want to try and cut back. It's really enlightening for them just to bounce off what we're talking about, what we're presenting in a short time. It only take them half an hour a day, if that, you know. So once a day for half an hour for 6 weeks, it's a great little thing, and you can decide whether your life's in a mess or not, or what you want to do with it, or how to step up into the next level of recovering from a self-destructive mechanism.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. We've covered so much today. I look forward to hearing from our listeners what resonated for them. Thank you so much, Reese and Lexi, for joining us on the topic of addictions and recovery. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Barnett. All righty.
All good.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.